Welcome to the Sustainable Nano Podcast. I'm your host, Miriam Kraus, and in this episode, we're really excited to bring you an interview with geobiologist Hope Jaron, who you may have heard of. She's a best-selling author of the memoir Lab Girl, and of course, if you're a geobiology person, you will have heard of her because she's a very prolific scientist studying isotopes and fossil organisms and how they relate to the global environment. So we were extremely lucky to score an interview with Dr. Jaron when she came to give a talk at Augsburg College here in Minneapolis last month. And we could have talked for hours. She had lots of interesting things to say. But this excerpt of the interview, she talks a lot about just her approach to communicating science, both to other scientists as well as to the public in something like Lab Girl, which is a very different style of writing, obviously, and the pleasure and value that she gets from both of those different kinds of communication. And we also end up talking a little bit about her thoughts on dealing with sexism in science after a long career. So I think you'll get a lot out of this interview. It was really, really interesting. The interviewer in this case is a second-year graduate student from the University of Minnesota, Natalie Hudson-Smith. And Natalie was a fan of the book Lab Girl before we even got a chance to set up this interview, so she was eager to be able to talk to Dr. Jaron. Natalie studies the toxicity of engineered nanoparticles here in the Center for Sustainable Nanotechnology. So you'll mostly be hearing her voice. You'll hear me a little bit in the background. Anyway, without further ado, here is Dr. Hope Jaron.
All right. I've prepared some questions. The first one we have is, at Sustainable Nano, we do a lot about explaining different scales of size.
Yeah.
And in the third part of the book, you have this analogy between your mass spectrometer and a bathroom scale. And we would like it if you could explain this analogy to our listeners who haven't read the book a little bit.
Okay, so I work with a mass spectrometer, which is a scientific instrument used in research and used for quite a lot of things. And quite a few scientists have them in their laboratories. So there's a lot of different kinds. And I try to explain what it is to people that don't spend time in laboratories. And I always try to connect it with something that they do have in their lives. And that kind of goes back to the philosophy of talking about science and science communication, is what can I connect about what I do to something that you have in your life, and not only that, something that you're very familiar with. And so we start with mass, you know, a mass spectrometer is something that measures something about mass, right? And what is mass? Mass is commonly experienced in people's everyday lives as something like weight. You know, how heavy is it? You pick it up. If there's a lot of it, it's got high mass. And if there's not a lot of it, it's got low mass. And so what I came up with as the measure of mass that people are most familiar with is their bathroom scale. They see that thing every day. Maybe they even use it every day. And what is it? It's something that differentiates one mass from another. It can tell you if you're on it versus you holding your little kid. And it can tell you very accurately which of those two scenarios is happening. There's never any question according to, you know, the readout you get as to the accuracy on that. I can tell whether it's just me or me and somebody else on the scale. And then I say, you know, basically what I've got is a scale, and it tells me the difference between two masses, except that I can tell you the difference between 1,000 molecules without a heavy nucleus in a certain percentage of the atoms versus a similar looking substance that doesn't have that same configuration of atomic chemistry. And then I go into how the mechanism, so how the scale works, is very different in the two machines. In your bathroom scale, there's a spring which is attached to a needle, and as you step on it, the spring feels the force and the needle moves accordingly. Only on my scale, there's no needle and there's no spring. There's a big magnet, and we ionize the particles and they separate themselves according to the movement in that magnetic field. So that's a long answer for a short question. But you can explain very, very difficult concepts to people who have no familiarity with scientific instrumentation or anything along those lines if you start from something that they're familiar with, if you start from their experience and build it out from there. I think that's the key to doing it well. And, you know, the other important thing to mention is that you should, right? Because who paid for this mass spectrometer? The person you're talking to. A little bit of the money that they earned doing their job, which is not scientific, trickle down to you somehow and put that thing in your lab. And so to me, it's fun, it's a challenge, and it's very rewarding. I talk to people who say, I wasn't good at science, I never liked science, but I read your book and I really liked it, or it made me feel like I can understand this stuff. And to me, that's a huge reward.
So to that note, do you have any other favorite go-to comparisons between an everyday object and something we might see in the lab?
Well, that's the other thing, is that a lot of these analogies are imperfect,
right?
And so nothing is really exactly like something else. If it were, they would both be the same thing, right? So that, you know, scientists always get really, you know, the analogy, you know, you sacrifice some meaning for the analogy or whatever. But, you know, that's a very small price to pay in terms of bringing somebody closer to you, in terms of, you know, really talking to them about the meaning and drive behind the science. I'm happy to sacrifice a little bit of the specific precise accuracy of the metaphor for that thing. For radioactive decay, I often talk about bank accounts. You know, that's the other thing you can talk about. People think they don't know a lot about numbers, but the numbers that they deal with every single day have to do with money. And most people do know about interest accumulating and things like that. And a lot of those functions, you know, there are certain investments that you can make if you're lucky that behave very much like the negative of exponential decay. There are also investments you can make that behave very much like exponential decay. So you can use, when I explain carbon dating, for example, I might say that, you know, you've got a bank account that builds up interest over time, and a carbon 14 measurement is, you know, very loosely speaking, the opposite of that. You know, something loses carbon 14 over time. We can tell how old it is by the ratio of the carbon 14 to carbon 12 that's in it now versus our assumption as to what it had when it first started waiting for us, you know. And talking about plants is a really wonderful thing, because most people do experience, they can talk to you about their garden, or people don't garden as much as they used to, but they often have plants in their yard. You can say, why, you know, when is your flower garden the nicest? When is your vegetable garden the nicest? And they know that. Of course they know that. And then you can talk about the reproductive cycle of a plant very easily. You know, first we get the flower, and then we get the fruit that follows the flower. And that's why you have beautiful flowers in the spring, and you're foisting all your vegetables on people in the fall. But science communication is always about coming to people where they are and trying to piggyback on their experience. And that sounds very simple, but it requires a different attitude than I think a lot of scientists use. And that is that the person listening to me lives a very rich life full of experiences, and full of experiences that are similar to my own, not in a detailed sense, but in an ultimate sense. You know, this person lives their life and they observe things, and in a way they measure things, and in a way they calculate things, and we can talk to each other about the details when we start from that place.
That's very cool. I think it's true that it's very easy to kind of get caught up in the lab and in the control you have and the kind of experiments that you think you're doing. And on that note of control, in part of the book, you talk about sometimes things don't work, no matter what you do. And you talk about your experience with the hackberry tree. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that and how it can be frustrating trying to study something that you want very much to control because you're a scientist and that's your methodology, but it has its own will and way in the world.
Right, right. You know, I mean, biological experiments, part of the reason they're wonderful is that living organisms are very, very difficult to control. And the fact that we don't see what we expect to see comes out of the fact that we don't understand these organisms, you know. So that frustration is part and parcel of why the work needs to happen. So that's something to remember. A tree is wonderful because you can't make it do anything, really. And we do have that, you know, in the lab. We've had times when, you know, all the organisms just die. I think if you talk to anybody who works with fruit flies or, you know, you get these kind of weird rapture events where where you walk into the lab and everything's dead, you know. You know, all the fruit fly people I know, the nematode people, that they really are, you know, my cultures didn't go or whatever it is. And one thing about the book was that I never got to tell those stories. I mean, there isn't any journal where you can, unless you really can come back and test a hypothesis and show clearly that something happened. There's a lot of moments like that where you learn something important, but there's no scientific outlet for what you learned and how you grew as a result of that happening. That, confounded with the fact that it's so very common, that it's such part and parcel of the job, just created over the years, over the decades, they're built up an incredible need in me to tell these stories, to talk about how my science had been shaped just as much by the things I couldn't make work as the things that I did make work. And also, it's very hard to communicate to students just what a large part of the scientific life that is. Because we do the incredible disservice of training them using these kind of cookbook experiments. You know, you follow the steps and it happens the way it's supposed to happen, and then you report the results. And that's how you train to be a scientist. That's how you train in chemistry and physics and stuff like that. But it's like, it'll never happen again. Right? You're doing things that don't need done, in a way. And you know, back to your question of control, you know, what's at control? Control is all about thinking you know what's going to happen and then seeing something else happen. I mean, that's the definition of trying to control it. And so we need to interrogate that, because our need for control really goes back to the fact that we've already convinced ourselves of the appropriateness of one hypothesis versus another. So control is actually bias when you think about it in a certain sense. I mean, the other thing that's hard to talk about, that's really fun to talk about, is that with the decades comes this weird wisdom that you can't really put your finger on, where you tell students, okay, if you set this up, you know, just don't put it near that windowsill. And I don't know why we've seen so many fail that have been near that windowsill, and there's probably a reason, and it's just not worth putting in whatever that confounding variable is or whatever. And then, you know, 10 years later, it might occur to me that, you know, when the guy comes to fix the heat register that's on the other side of the room, that he says, oh, that one's been blocked on that windowsill all along, and I finally figure it out that, you know, there's some kind of thermal cycling happening that doesn't happen on that side of the lab. You know, years and years later, maybe I put that all together. But there's this weird wisdom that comes from experience that's much more like craftsmanship, that's much more like what you learn if you do a lot of carpentry or a lot of sewing or a lot of cooking, than it is, you know, what we associate with scientific expertise. And writing the book was also about showing how that grows and where it comes from, and what an incredible reward it is. You know, how really that is such a wonderful thing to feel yourself grow in that way and become more and more whole. By doing that work. And again, that's also something you can't put on your CV. You know, it's something you can't publish in a journal. But it's a huge part of science.
So, actually, speaking of publishing,
something
that grad students like myself have to learn to do to publish is to write in a scientific voice, which is almost like having no voice at all. It doesn't feel like you wrote it. It doesn't have my style, that kind of thing. And it's very passive, as if experiments just did themselves one day.
Yeah.
So my question for you is it hard to make a tone shift to go from writing something mostly about your work in this one scientific tone to writing a book like Lab Girl?
Yeah. It's very different type of writing. I love to do scientific writing. I actually love to write papers and help write papers and things like that, because it's more like poetry than like writing, right? Because, I mean, the challenge is that, you know, especially if you put something together for one of these short form journals where you really don't have a lot of space, the challenge is, you know, how do you distill the work of, you know, 4 years by five people? How do you distill that down to 3,500 words or something? And there isn't a lot of space for, there isn't any space for anything that you don't have to say. And interjecting a point of view, you know, if we can somehow remove the human point of view from that, we can streamline it down. And so I don't think it's, you know, this horrible problem that scientific writing is cold or dehumanized or something like that. I think it's part and parcel with the form. You know, it's like iambic pentameter in Shakespeare, right? It's like there's a form to this kind of writing. But it also means that it's not the only form, right? I mean, not everybody wants to sit around and read iambic pentameter, and there should be other ways that we can learn life's lessons aside from that one single form. And so I did turn to the book in order to inject particularly human point of view. But in fact, now that I've written the book, I'm getting back to doing more writing for journals and things like that, and it's really, really fun. So, you know, for students, there's just no substitute for practice, 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 you know? Write it down. Why am I writing this? So your lab book is a great thing. You've got the experiment. Write the story of how you did it. Write it in two different ways. One, the way you would for an academic paper, and one, the way you did if you were writing a letter to your best friend. How are they different? What are the verbs you used in the one? What are the verbs you used in the other? What is the tense you used in the one? And none of these things are, you know, you're not necessarily going to publish either one, but that's how you learn. You know, there's a great deal of joy and growth to come from just interrogating your own writing style. And which type of style do you gravitate more towards, and which type of style is going to take more work for you to learn? But it is like learning another language and another way of doing things. But, you know, a good scientific paper, there's something pure about a well-written scientific paper that just explains the scientific phenomenon as gracefully and sparingly as possible when it goes right. It's something to aspire to.
Yeah, I've never thought about it as like a poetry similarity before, but now that you say it, my first thought is haikus, because they're so short, but they're meant to evoke a moment, a whole set of feelings.
Right, right. And you can write something else. It's just not haiku, right?
Yep.
You know, and why did they develop the haiku? I mean, the challenge is, you know, how much can you put into this 575 or whatever it is, you know? And when you read a great haiku and you've got an entire moment and an entire feeling and an entire place all wrapped into this, it's really a remarkable thing. One more we didn't get to.
Yeah. So you talk a lot in this book about sexism, and at one point you define it as the cumulative weight of constantly being told you can't possibly be what you are. But you also have a span of a career, and you've worked in different countries, and I was wondering if you could note any differences over time or also geographically in the sexism in academia.
Yeah. Well, I can only speak to my experience,
sure,
right? So what the book comes down to really is one woman's experience. And it's a very imperfect woman, if you've noticed from reading this. I mean, that's the other strange thing that's come of this book, is that when women talk about their lives, you know, even standing up and talking about your life is seen as you putting forward yourself as something to judge yourself against, right? Which is really strange. It's almost like the beauty magazines, right? Mm-hmm. Which are full of these pictures of women wearing different things and looking different and, you know, born with whatever hair color and eye color they have or whatever. And we're taught, I think, to look at those pictures and immediately catalog our own differences from them. In what ways am I different than her? Which is one thing, right? We're all different. But the subtext of that is that because she's in the magazine, because she's on the medium of communication, she's the thing that we're supposed to be like, right? And what I didn't realize is how much that would transfer into being a character in a book, which is basically what I am if you don't know me, right? I'm a character in a book. When you tell people about the wackiest things that have happened to you, that's very different than purporting to put together some kind of recipe for success or something like that. And so that's been really interesting. I think in terms of how women are treated in society and in science, I think the issues that we encounter in science are a microcosm of the way women are valued in society. And so, you know, thinking back to my original training in feminist studies, I was taught that most women's issues come back to three fundamental phenomena, and those are sexual violence, reproductive rights, and the contrast between public and private labor. And I think in science, what I see as driving issues all relate to that. Equal pay for equal work, how pregnancy and reproduction is handled in terms of the career trajectory, and the sexual violence that we experience within our scientific settings on a continuum from harassment all the way to rape and even murder. And so, you know, these are women's issues. These are reflections of the same issues that women struggle with in their daily lives. I like to say this is part and parcel of what it means to walk through the world wearing a woman's body. And so we have pieces of that that we see in science. And what I think is interesting about it is, why are we so shocked by that? Why did we expect science to be free of it? I mean, for some reason, we hold science to a different standard, as if it's almost not done by people that are subject to the problems and challenges that come along with this learned power imbalance between men and women that drives all the powerful institutions of our society. Do they differ with different regions and different institutions? Yes, definitely. But every institution mm-hmm. has its expression of these particular struggles. And I also don't have the answers, right? I mean, this is part of a journey that every woman on the planet is on, you know, how to achieve justice in the face of these issues. But personally, I can't see how we can make progress without all of us starting to openly talk about it. I feel like that's a necessary step and a first step. And I've tried to do that very plainly and openly. And I'm watching and waiting and pressing the issue to see, you know, how that changes our scientific environments. And I hope it will, towards the more open and the better.
I wish we could spend another half hour on this super interesting topic that I see we're waiting for. But thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
All right, that's it for today's episode of Sustainable Nano. Thank you again very much to Dr. Jaron for doing the interview with us and to Natalie Hudson-Smith for conducting the interview. Sustainable Nano is a production of the Center for Sustainable Nanotechnology, which in turn is funded by the National Science Foundation. Thanks, as always, to the NSF for that support. We always have to have our standard disclaimer that the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of the National Science Foundation. If you'd like to learn more about Dr. Jaron, you can follow her on Twitter at HopeJaron, J-A-H-R-E-N. Of course, read the book Lab Girl. It's great. We've linked to a few different reviews and interviews and other interesting things in our show notes, which you can always find at podcast.sustainable-nano.com. That's also where you can find all of our previous episodes if you haven't caught up with the podcast before. And you can subscribe on iTunes and Stitcher as well. You can also find us on Twitter and Facebook at Sustainable Nano, all one word. And if you want more, you can read our blog, sustainable-nano.com. We've got over 200 posts at this point, all about various topics related to sustainability, nanotechnology, and life in science. One of our recent posts that you might enjoy is all about the nanoscience of skis and skiing. So go check it out. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you for our next episode in just a couple of weeks.